coming up on KSDP News, scientists are examining the rendering process for seal oil. And after an anthrax outbreak, some are pointing fingers to thawing permafrost. Stay tuned. Good afternoon. You're listening to KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint. I'm Marissa Williams with some local news on Wednesday, August 31st, 2016. Russian officials say warming permafrost could be linked to a deadly anthrax outbreak in Siberia this month, and permafrost can be found almost everywhere in Alaska, from the Arctic coast to Anchorage. But at least one expert isn't alarmed about the potential for thawing ground to bring old diseases back to life. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Zoe Sobel has the story.
After a Siberian heat wave, anthrax hit the Yamal Peninsula in early August. The bacterial disease has claimed the life of a child and thousands of reindeer. Permafrost expert Vladimir Romanovsky of the University of Alaska Fairbanks says melting permafrost and erosion may have worked together to spread anthrax into the water supply.
Thawing of permafrost can release microorganisms first into the active layer, then into water and air, which were sequestered there for many, many years, tens of years, and even thousands and tens of thousands of years.
Romanovsky says scientists have talked about the possibility of epidemics caused by thawing permafrost, but until now, it's only been a theory. If the Siberian anthrax outbreak is traced back to spores in the permafrost, it would be a troubling development.
This release of this dangerous microorganism could actually be spread very easily from the north, because we have lots of birds who are migrating all kind of places in the world. So this problem could be not just local problem, it could be global problem.
Romanovsky says more research is needed to tie this anthrax outbreak to warming permafrost. Dr. David Morins is an infectious disease specialist with the National Institutes of Health. He's not worried about anthrax or any other disease surfacing from the ground. He says anthrax is hardy, and it's virtually everywhere.
Anthrax is sitting in the grass and farms in Texas, and it's in Asia, it's in Africa, it's everywhere. And so the fact that some might be in the permafrost doesn't really add to whatever the risk is.
Although anthrax is widespread, the chance of getting sick from it is really small, and the likelihood of contracting anthrax from spores exhumed from the permafrost, even tinier. Morins has studied the 1918 Spanish influenza pandemic that decimated rural villages in Alaska. Brevik Mission was hit especially hard. Spanish flu killed 90% of the village over the course of 6 days. The remains of the victims were buried together. A team of researchers has used samples from that mass grave to reconstruct the genetic code of the virus. But Morin says Alaskans shouldn't be afraid of getting sick as the ground in Brevik Mission thaws. He says unlike anthrax, Spanish flu is very fragile.
What came out of the so-called permafrost was just broken pieces of RNA, nucleic acid. There was nothing infectious. A ton of it swallowed would have been harmless.
Freezing and thawing breaks up viruses like Spanish flu, killing them.
So if we're talking about viruses and deadly things, I would say that for all intents and purposes, whatever might be there in the permafrost is not going to be contagious.
Morins doesn't fear viruses or bacteria emerging from their cryogenic slumber, but he is concerned about the threat of new diseases.
All these emerging viruses that keep coming on, Zika and chikungunya and SARS and all that, it's not that they're being created. It's not that they're being dug up from the permafrost. It's that they're already there. And we human beings do things that kind of invite them to come in and infect us and cause epidemics.
Officials in Russia are trying to stop the anthrax outbreak from spreading further. They are incinerating all infected reindeer carcasses and have banned hunting in the region. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Zoe Sobel in Unalaska.
With the help of a botulism expert, food researchers are trying to combine science and Alaska Native traditions to make one prohibited food safe to eat. The state of Alaska doesn't accept or distribute seal oil donations due to the danger of botulism, a potentially fatal disease that's caused by bacteria in a contaminated food. but how or when the newer toxins enter the rendering process is still a mystery. That's what researchers are trying to find out. KMXT's Kayla Desroches has more.
Val Crail describes seal oil as a little bit like a heavy olive oil. He's the administrator of Utuquinot Enot, a long-term care facility in Kotzebue that falls under the Manelik Association. He says elders at the facility identified seal oil as a priority food.
For them, it's like eating butter. This is just part of their daily diet. This is what they've always been eating. And in terms of health, it's actually healthier than fish oil. So there's a lot of benefit to eating seal oil.
But because the bacteria that causes botulism grows in an anaerobic environment, or one without exposure to oxygen, traditional methods using containers like bottles or barrels can lead to contamination. The challenge is how to prevent the risk of poisoning while working with the traditional techniques. Crail says beginning last year, Manelik started looking for ways to get a variance approved to distribute seal oil. He's one of a number of Alaskans interested in getting prohibited traditional foods safe and approved for consumption, and he hopes to clear the way for other programs. The first step in the mission was to turn to regulators. Lorinda Laca, a section manager with the State of Alaska Food Safety and Sanitation Program, says the state was willing to allow organizations to serve the seal oil if they could demonstrate a safe process. However, she explains Manelik needed to reach out to resources other than the state.
We do testing, but it's usually in result of outbreaks of illness. We don't do a lot of preventative testing to help evaluate the safety of the product. So it's usually just in response to illnesses, and our labs don't have that capacity.
So along the way, Manelik got in touch with UAF's Kodiak Seafood and Marine Science Center, and Dr. Eric Johnson, a botulism specialist and professor of bacteriology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He has a long history in researching botulism, and his lab is registered for toxin analysis. Johnson says he'll watch the traditional process in action in the community of Kotzebue, and once he understands the preparation, examine samples in his lab.
My interest is in helping validate the process from a safety perspective. For example, what aspects in this process may contribute to the growth of Clostridium botulinum and its formation of toxins, and to implement minor changes in the process that will enhance its safety.
While the Seafood and Marine Science Center is not registered to work with toxins, it does focus on the research of seafood. Associate Professor of Seafood Microbiology Brian Himmelblum explains they can study the other aspects of a seal oil sample, like what it's composed of and how much water is left in the extract.
Because that will give us an idea when things go bad, maybe that's because some of that seal oil has some residual water available, and that's where we theorize where Clostridium botulinum is actually going to operate.
Himmelblum says, in theory, the preparers of the seal oil can avoid a botulism incident if they pour off 100% oil.
But in their mixing, if they're splashed over from water, or if they're not careful how they're pouring it off, maybe that's the situation, because under what we call ambient temperatures, room temperature or outside temperature, that's probably in the range where this organism can proliferate.
So far, it's all speculation. The trick, according to Himmelblum and the other researchers, is to find the solution while keeping scientific intervention to a minimum.
So if we can combine those two worlds of traditional knowledge and Western science, we might actually come to the point of, oh, now we know how we can most likely guarantee, hopefully, that there won't be a botulism incident if they follow these particular steps.
Next, researchers will observe the traditional process, and then, through collaboration with each other, Manelik, and other community partners in Kotzebue, they'll decide on what they should test and how much of it. I'm Kayla Desroches.
And that's the news from Sandpoint. This is Marissa Williams, and you're listening to KSDP 830 AM.